This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, you're listening to Beyond the Ballot Box with me, Dashran Johan. It's been a wild week in Malaysian politics, and that's saying something. From Law Minister Takuddin Hassan blunder in Parliament, PN clashing with the monarch, Parliament being postponed and then postponed again and then later barricaded altogether, to, of course, as we probably all come to expect by now, more numbers game. All of this taking place, mind you, against the backdrop of more than 200 daily COVID-19 deaths. So it's a mess, a huge mess. But what does any of it mean to us, the common folk? Joining me on the show to unpack it all is O.A. San, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. Welcome to the show, A. San. How are you doing?
Well, I've been keeping myself busy commenting on all these political developments.
Yeah, I can only imagine how busy you must be, A. San. So let's get right into it. You know, we've got a lot to talk about, but, you know, let's start from last Monday. As we know, opposition MPs were blocked from entering Parliament by not just cops, but also the riot police, and there were threats of water cannons, right? I mean, the opposition MPs then proceeded to participate in a protest of their own, marching in Dataran Merdeka, carrying a sign that reads, Mahiadin Letak Jawatan. What did you make of all of this?
Well, number one, to put it in a broader picture, it is indeed very saddening to see, shall we say, the fall from political grace of Muhyiddin and by extension, those who are following his political train. Barely, let's say, a year and a half ago before the Sheraton move, Muhyiddin and perhaps many others such as Asmin and so on, they were considered part of the reformist movements, right? Forming a new government and hopefully ushering in a new dawn for Malaysia's politics and society and economy and so on. Then the events of the Sheraton move, suddenly transformed them into, number one, very powerful figures, but number two, also increasingly authoritarian figure. Four figures, and that culminated, of course, in what you just mentioned, namely the barricading of the Malaysian Parliament last Monday. And of course, this is not the first time that Parliament has been barricaded in the Commonwealth jurisdictions. I can recall many other examples, like Zimbabwe would spring to mind, right? Those are, of course, not stellar examples of democracy. And it is indeed a very sad day in that sense. Members of parliament being stopped from discharging their duties as the voice and the representative of the people here.
Certainly. And that's, you know, I want to ask you, what does all of this say about the state of democracy in Malaysia right now? Because you brought up Zimbabwe as an example. Over the past few days, you know, when they barricaded Parliament in Malaysia, a couple of journalists on Twitter, you know, even posted how, you know, in Myanmar, they barricaded Parliament, and then right beside they put a picture of Malaysia also barricading Parliament. Now, for the regular person processing all of this, right, what does it actually say about the state of democracy in Malaysia right now? Which direction are we heading towards? I mean, is a situation like Myanmar realistically around the corner?
Well, it is interesting that you mentioned Myanmar, because I recall 2 months before the late Tan Sri Lim Kok Weng of Lim Kok Weng University passed away, we had a conversation, right? And he mentioned some of the parents of his foreign students. They were actually worried because, number one, they confused Malaysia with Myanmar, because both with M and Y letters, right? And number two, we were both under emergencies. So some of their parents refused to send their kids back to Malaysia, thinking we were under military rule and so on. But of course, well, the only lucky thing about Malaysia is we have a very professional military who never, and I really hope would also never dabble in politics in any way, right? So the, in that sense, what we are seeing now actually is still very much a power struggle among the political elites. So we, the voters, we voted in all these different politicians. And now, the well, some of these politicians are in power, as I say, fall from political grace, going down the authoritarian route and so on. And some other politicians would like to replace them. And but I think the thing is also this, we are actually not so sure when the current slate of political powers that be are replaced by a new slate of political figures, that the new slate of political figures will indeed be, again, as we hope, reformist-minded, bringing in new dawn of Malaysian politics and society and so on. We are simply not sure, but we are reduced to being spectators, you know, at the sideline as this power struggles unfolds.
And is that all we can be, Ehsan, reduced to spectators, you know, just watching from the sidelines? Because a couple of friends texted me and, you know, I mean, these are friends that are not necessarily, you know, constantly engaging with politics or, you know, yelling their opinions on Twitter. So they texted me and they just asked, what does this all mean? I mean, like, how many people are confused and not sure what to make of the situation. You know, should the common person care about the events that have transpired over the past week? How does it affect the common person?
Well, number one, of course, this is a lesson that we almost like a civics lesson that we have to go through. Some people have put it as growing pains as a democracy that we have to go through, and we must learn from the process. And we are actually very lucky because, as you mentioned, we are not like Myanmar, right? With military going on the streets with guns and so on. Number two, I think, as we go through this political sort of mess, we should also keep in mind what are actually the proper way of going about carrying on with political struggles. We inherited the British Westminster parliamentary democracy or constitutional monarchy system. So you see, all these political actors, they are actually supposed to be sort of gentlemanly to each other, courteous to each other and so on. And when some of these actors are not as gentlemanly, are not as courteous, and indeed abuse and misuse some of the longstanding traditions of Westminster's in order to keep themselves in power, then we are really in a lot of trouble. So I think the first thing to do is to actually go to Wikipedia and look at what is Westminster system, right? And then you compare how it should be with what you're observing now. For example, as you mentioned, barricading parliaments and so on in order to prevent members of parliament from voting on various motions and then thereby prolonging this government, whether that is right or wrong. Yeah.
I want to, you know, dive a little deeper into, you know, the growing pains of democracy towards the end of our conversation. But now let's unpack the events that have unfolded. So after, you know, after the whole barricading parliament, and this was then followed by something I think Malaysians probably are you're growing accustomed to over the past year or so, you know, secret meetings, special announcements, and something perhaps new to Malaysian politics, PDFs. A lot of PDFs all the time are, you know, just being released on Twitter. Then UMNO announced that they are officially pulling out of the Perikatan National Government. We don't quite know the exact numbers, but as of right now, it seems like somewhere between 8 to 12 MPs from UMNO have committed to leaving Perikatan National. And many say that this means that Muhyiddin doesn't have the numbers anymore. Muhyiddin, of course, came out and said that he does. Where do you stand on the matter?
Okay, number one, there's actually nothing intrinsically wrong with all these so-called secret meetings in hotels and so on. In fact, they are part and parcel of what makes a parliamentary democracy healthy. Namely, for example, not one single party or coalition could command a parliamentary majority. Therefore, they enter into political negotiations, right? And some of these negotiations are secrets. There are countries around the world which mandate that such political negotiations be done openly. Two countries come into my mind. Number one, Germany. You see, like after the last German elections, it took them, I think, 6 months to try to form a government. And during this period, all the different parties, they have to formally hold meetings to negotiate with each other. The other example is, of course, Israel forming a government across the political spectrum. And again, the formation of the government was announced officially from a hotel rooms with some of the Arabs and the Israelis, meeting there to forge their deals and so on. So that is nothing wrong. But of course, then it comes to the question of which side or who or which coalition actually holds the parliamentary majority at the moment. And I will be very frank with you, we don't know. We can variously make our own respective calculations, right, at the back of the envelope and so on and say, oh, Muhyiddin does not have the number or Anwar has the number and so on. But it's just like the, I think a famous Japanese film director, I think it was Kurosawa, his famous film in the 1950s is Rosamond, right? Rosamond. A lot of things are going on. By the end of the day, you don't know what is going on. But what matters ultimately is the opinion or the view of His Majesty the King, because our constitution explicitly mentions that the king shall appoint a member of parliament who, in the king's view, so in the king's subjective opinion, is likely to command a majority. Likely to command a majority doesn't mean already commanding a majority. It's just that he's likely. Just like when Muhyiddin was appointed last year after the Sheraton move, I think at the point of appointment, Muhyiddin did not have a majority. But the king views that that Muhyiddin is likely to command a majority. So that's why there are all this scrambling for statutory declarations or at least a PDF scans of all this statutory declarations and so on. The whole point is actually to convince the king that a certain leader is likely to command a majority and therefore should be appointed as prime minister.
Is that a new president, Oisan? Because based on my understanding, the first option is always to test the numbers at parliament, and that becomes the sort of playground where these problems are resolved legitimized and all sorts of things, right? But because of what happened last year, where basically, all the if you remember after Lanka Sheraton, all the politicians, many factions, nobody could come to, a very obvious consensus. And so the YDPA, invited all the MPs to his palace, interviewed them one by one. And then, like you brought up, it wasn't a very obvious majority, but the YDPA claimed that, he, based on his subjective opinion, that, Tan Sri Muhyiddin Yassin has the, is most likely to garner the majority and the rest is history. Do you see a similar thing will be happening this time around as well?
Well, yes, because that is constitutionally mandated. The king is actually very conscientious and very conscious about discharging his duties within constitutional bounds. But the problem is this, last year after Muhyiddin's appointment, in the ordinary course of events, if you follow Westminster's unwritten constitutional conventions which this country subscribes to, Muhyiddin should expeditiously, very fast, go to parliament and ask for a motion of confidence. And if he wins that motions of confidence, then he should carry on as prime minister. If he loses, he should step down. That is normal course of events. But as you also saw, Muhyiddin has been trying his best to avoid these motions, right? When there was parliamentary sitting last year, he deliberately put all these motions of confidence at the end of every day's parliamentary agenda. And then parliament would adjourn at 2 o'clock and say, oh, no time to consider the rest of the agenda for today. So that he avoided the motion of confidence with that. And then this year, he advised the king to proclaim emergency, allegedly to combat the pandemic. But everybody knows he saw that parliament could not meet. And I mean, that he could legally not let parliament meet in order, again, to avoid parliamentary votes. And then later on, when the king repeatedly... you see, it's like tabalik, the king advised the prime minister, right? So usually the prime minister advises the king, right? The king advised the prime minister is also within constitutional bounds, Westminster unwritten constitutional bounds. Namely, the king could advise, could admonish, that means to warn and to encourage the government. So that is okay. So when Muhyiddin said, okay, finally, I'm going to hold parliament, cannot vote. Parliament has no vote. Parliament could only listen to briefing, right? And then he misled parliament some more in order to avoid parliamentary votes. That's why after all these things, how then you test Muhyiddin's parliamentary majority? That's why the king yesterday summoned Muhyiddin again and say, hey, hello, there are members of parliament writing in to me saying they withdraw the support from you. So what are you going to do? Then Muhyiddin, I think at that point, promised the king, okay, finally, I'm going to bring a motion of confidence in next month's parliamentary sitting. I think that was the understanding between Muhyiddin and His Majesty. Yeah.
Right. On the show with me today is O.A. Sun, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. After the break, I'll be asking him if what we are experiencing right now from Lanka Sheraton to this current political turbulence that we've seen over the past week, if it's inevitable, if it's all part of the early stages of a young democratic nation. We'll be back with more on Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Beyond the Ballot Box. I'm Dashran Johan, and on the show with me today is O.A. Sun, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs. And we're talking about the confusing, some might say frustrating week in Malaysian politics. So, A-san, let's entertain the scenario, right, that the Prime Minister decides to take the high road. Let's say he calls for a vote of confidence in Parliament, either in September or maybe, you know, he takes the higher road and calls it like within the next week or so. And then let's just say he doesn't have the numbers, he admits defeat, he resigns, and then he's defeated in parliament and all of that. What next? Because while it may seem that, you know, there are so many MPs rallying against Muhyiddin and that he does not have the numbers, it seems, at the same time, it doesn't mean that there is enough MPs rallying behind someone else in particular, right? For example, Anwar. So where do we go from there?
Okay. Well, number one, I highly doubt with Muhyiddin's less than stellar political record after he took over as prime minister, as we mentioned just now, that he would take the high road. And, you know, introducing the motion, and if he's defeated in the motion of confidence, that he will gracefully resign. I frankly think he would not take such a high road. Number one, it is questionable whether we will have actually a parliamentary sitting in September because of the mounting pandemic number, which he has been using in order to delay parliamentary sitting. Number two, even if there's a sitting, I am not sure what kind of other constitutional tricks he's going to pull out from his hat in order to delay tabling a motion of confidence. But let's give him the benefit of doubt and say he would take the high road, right? Mm-hmm. Then the intention of UMNO is important. I think all this while, it has mainly been UMNO making all the noises, withdrawing support and so on, because opposition, of course, by definition, does not support Muhyiddin. Therefore, I think UMNO is actually trying to still keep this ruling coalition intact, but with UMNO in charge instead of Muhyiddin or Bersatu in charge. If Muhyiddin and Bersatu, by extension, concede the ruling coalition's leadership to UMNO, then somebody from UMNO would be the new prime minister, right? With Muhyiddin, perhaps, I'm just guessing, perhaps becoming like a minister mentor or so on, right?
Right.
With still a very elevated position. But of course, within UMNO itself, a lot of people are jostling for powers already, right? The current official UMNO leadership, Zahid, the former Prime Minister Najib, and also some others like the new Deputy Prime Ministers, namely Ismail Sabri. Guli is once again tossing his hat, and then there's a dark horse in Hisham, and so on. So a lot of people are already sort of gunning for UMNO's leadership, and therefore clinching the premiership. Shall Muhyiddin step down? Now, failing which, of course, the king might also call for indeed Anwar Ibrahim and say, okay, finally it's your chance, but please go ahead. Let's say within a week or within a month, call for a vote in parliament. Yeah,
right. So you brought up Najib earlier, and I think a burning question in the minds of many Malaysians is that in this Malaysian so-called Game of Thrones, how close or far is former Prime Minister Najib Razak from reclaiming the Iron Throne?
Okay, over the past, let's say, half a year, right, as a lot of your friends tweeted or texted you about what's going on and so on, there was actually a very public figure in the form of Professor Najib Razak, right?
Right.
In his daily telegrams as well as other social media platforms, teaching us what's going on in terms of politics. Sometimes you would have, I think, up to 20 or even 50 tweets or telegram messages in a day telling you what is going on with very detailed graphic presentations of our socioeconomic developments and so on. So I think at least in the minds of many people, even though, you know, with all this 1MDB tainted image and so on, Najib is somewhat rehabilitated. And this rehabilitation is not only politically, I think it's even a public, sort of a public rehabilitation. And therefore, there are people, I think an increasing number of people who are thinking, hey, well, you see, Najib knows what he's talking, and he should return as prime minister. Of course, again, if Muhyiddin were to step down, or shall we say, made to step down, right? Then the field for premiership, it's open to almost anybody, right? The king, in his opinion, may feel that indeed Najib could command a majority, and of course, being a prime minister, a former prime minister, and shall we say, in terms of handling the economics and so on, proved to be a rather successful one. So yeah, the king might indeed hand it over and say, hey, why don't you try it out? But again, prove your majority in parliament. Yeah.
Hmm. And so with that in mind, right, let's say if you are indeed a Barisan fan, or you're on the fence and you're still considering, let's say, UMNO or Barisan Nasional, you're still considering to vote for them, perhaps these developments may come off as positive for you. And in that sense, okay, fine. But what if you are on the side of the quote-unquote progressives, right? And you are you're worried about the current developments that Najib Tun Razak might become the prime minister again. How should the common folk on this side of the camp process this information?
Well, I think it is important to realize that politics, it's the art of compromise, number one. And number two, is also the art of the impossible, right? Again, if you look at examples from those two examples, Germany and Israel. In Germany, I think after the coming general election, it is very likely that they are going to have a coalition, a ruling coalition which stands across the most progressive left to the most conservative right. In Israel, it's even, you know, the Jews and the Arabs who are like, I don't want to use the term mortal, but generational enemies of each other. They are actually forming ruling coalition within with their respective parties. So whether we like it or not, we have to sort of recognize the fact that sometimes you don't get to have your cake and get to eat it as well, as they say colloquially, right? You might have your cake, but you may need to share it with some of your mortal enemies, or somebody else. The other side might have the cake and you get to have a bite of it. And that, unfortunately, is part and parcel of electoral politics.
Right. Now, how much of an impact has Perikatan Nasional's clash with the Yang di-Pertuan Agong over the past week impacted their popularity, particularly in the Malay heartland?
Well, number one, the Perikatan Nasional, or shall we put it more specifically, Bersatu, has never enjoyed quite a lot of support in the Malay heartland. Well, Bersatu won their seats on the coattail of, at that time, Pakatan Harapan, right? The more progressive fronts. And shall we say, those who joined Bersatu later, many of them are from UMNO, and they won their seats under UMNO's umbrellas. So there's not much, shall we say, Malay heartland support to talk about in terms of Bersatu. And of course, the Malay heartlands being very conservative and so on, this very public clash with the royalty on the side of Bersatu and Muhyiddin, of course, would further erode their future electoral support, right? Assuming we do have a future general election and not be postponed like in Sarawak, and again, at the instigation of a pandemic and so on, right? So yeah, it's going to erode the electoral support. Number two, a lot of, you're talking about the socio-economic difficulties faced by many people across, shall we say, racial, religious, or other sort of divides, right? Everybody is having tough times. You see people, no matter Malay, Chinese, Indians, Kadazans, and Dayaks, all raising their white flags, right? So, this government sort of has a disconnect between those who are very much in power and the realities on the grounds. Come on, realistically, 500 ringgit and so on, how long is it going to last, a family of quite a few number of people? It's like when there are fires breaking out somewhere, you rush the firefighters to put out the fires, right? You don't have a comprehensive fire prevention plan, right? And that goes with both the pandemic combat effort as well as the resuscitation of our socioeconomic well-being. Yeah.
I'm also wondering, right, because you said that Bersatu doesn't have much grip in the Malay heartland, particularly because a lot of them ran in urban seats under the Pakatan banner and all of that. But there is a component to Perikatan Nasional that definitely their primary demographic is the Malay heartland, and that is PAS, because Law Minister Takuddin Hassan, he was the one that, you know, started off this chain of events, right? The blunder in Parliament, if we can call it a blunder. So I'm wondering if this past week has diminished PAS's popularity in places like Kelantan and Terengganu.
Now you go into a very detailed, shall we say, a division of Malaysians' political affiliations and so on. Mm-hmm. I think PAS's major appeal, it's a religious one. They want to eventually turn this country into a theocratic rule, right? And that is their main political and religious appeal. So PAS supporters support PAS mainly because of their very religious appeal. It's not so much because of their nationalistic / racialist appeal. And the reverence for royalty has more to do with this second, shall we say, nationalistic and racialistic appeal.
Right.
So the past, shall we say, diehard supporters would still go full throttle for past because they would like that kind of theocratic rule in the future. For them, that's a very good thing. Whereas those who are more nationalistic, racialistic, and therefore reverent of the royalty, typically they are more voting for UMNO. So therein lies the very fine distinction within the Malay heartlands. Of course, there are interlap or overlap between these two cohorts of voters, but they are also, shall we say, slightly distinct. Yeah.
Mm. Now, what do you make of the opposition MPs dialing up the quote-unquote Derhaka angle to 11? Now, many constitutional lawyers have voiced their concern. You know, these constitutional lawyers, they always say His Majesty should not be dragged into the political problems of us common folk, and that, you know, relying on the royalty to solve our problems could lead to potential complications in the future. What do you make of this?
Well, number one, this sort of Derhaka call for actions and so on, primarily from the side of the opposition, is actually to make up their own deficit in the support base among this, as I pointed out, the more nationalistic or racialist cohorts of voters, right? I mean, Pakatan, they did very well in urban, more progressive seats, but in this traditionally UMNO held racialist and nationalistic seats, they did not do so well. So they are trying to, of course, claim some footholds in this in these constituencies, number one. Number two, this sort of royal interventions, of course, too proactive royal intervention is not in accordance with the Westminster's constitutional tradition, which traditionally would dictate some sort of, shall we say, royal indifference to politics, right? Because of the constitutional crisis and impasse brought about, again, by Muhyiddin himself, because he refuses to submit so far to various motions of confidence and so on. Therefore, it is understandable that there are a lot of people clamoring for more proactive royal intervention. I, for one, for example, last week, advocated a reference to the 1975 Australian constitutional crisis, during which the Australian Governor General, equivalent to the head of state, fired or dismissed a sitting prime minister who was very recalcitrant, very anti-democratic, trying to stretch constitutional bounds and so on. Now, I raised that example for reference by His Majesty. Lo and behold, 2 days later, our former Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir, also raised the same example for His Majesty's reference, right? So, you know, a lot of us are calling for this sort of quick fixes, but of course, we have to be cognizant of the long-term constitutional ramifications. Yeah.
Okay, and I guess that brings us full circle to this democracy, this battle for the soul of Malaysia's democracy, if you want to call it that, right? Isan, is a lot of what we're experiencing right now inevitable? You know, after all, the people of Malaysia voted out the ruling Barisan National Government in GE14. It was the first time something like that happened in Malaysia's history. And perhaps it was the signal, right, that we went from a sort of pseudo-democracy or a false democracy to a somewhat proper democracy. But we are dealing But right now we are in the infant stages and we are dealing with the inevitable consequences of our actions in the 14th general elections. Are Malaysians finally discovering what infant stages of democracy in a nation looks like?
Yes, it is very much, it's a long drawn out learning process for all of us, starting at least from 1998 during the Reformasi times, right? When we were thinking of trying to have a change in government. It dragged out for two decades until 2018, when finally the former long ruling government was toppled. But you see, these are essentially battles for, both politically as well as, philosophically, conservative versus the progressives, Pakatan versus Barisan and so on. But notice, for example, my ex-boss Najib, when he lost the election, he gracefully stepped down. When Dr. Mahathir felt that he was no longer in command of a majority, again, he resigned, right? So these were all playing very much within the Westminster constitutional bounds. But when you have, in a sense, some players who, like if you use American terms, went rock, like in the Star Wars series, there was one episode called The Rock One, right? Then you, when you have like a rock regime trying its best to hold on to power by stretching constitutional bounds, then you really have a problem here. And the only lucky star for us, as I mentioned just now, is we don't have a very activist military, right? I think we should all be cognizant of that. And the fact that just like when we were students, sometimes, we have to study very hard for various exams. But make sure those are proper exams. Those are not, hopefully, those are not exams which have been rigged, right? Such that the teachers actually told the answers for some favorite students already, right? So that it's not like that. But if it is not like that, it's a fair and square exams. Then all of us as a people, as voters, would have to study hard for it. Yeah.
And speaking of studying hard, right? I speak to some of my friends outside of this circle, and some of them say, what can we do? Politics will always be like this. You know, at the end of the day, we are just, you know, we can't do anything. We have no power. You know, we voted last elections for the first time. So look at where we are now. So next time, no need to vote. These are sentiments that you hear a lot, and these are sentiments that are understandable. But I'm wondering if you think it's important for the people of Malaysia to be politically engaged now more than ever, given that we are in this infant stages of democracy. How crucial is this period in Malaysian politics?
Well, it is very crucial indeed. Again, if we go back to the analogy of studying and taking exams and so on, if you don't study, if you don't go to school, you don't take exams, you're failing out of the school system. You're ponteng scholar. And therefore, your future is very much limited. You will have a very, very bleak socioeconomic future. So thereby, at the very least, you must continue to go out to vote if indeed there's a general election. I'm not even sure there will be one. I'm at that suspicious stage nowadays, looking at this government's record. Number two, you could also get politically active, right? You see a lot of young people engaging themselves, first of all, trying to change the immediate communities, their neighborhoods, making your neighborhood more livable. And if your neighbors then consider you a very good leader, then you might actually be more proactive in certain political movements and make the change for your district, your state, and hopefully by extension for the country. These are not something new. Imagine people living in war-torn zones, people living in Myanmar, you know, how brave they are in order to bring about changes to their I don't know, a million times more serious situations than this country. We are just looking at power struggles. We are not looking at, for example, our lives being threatened physically by the authorities, by the power that be. So yeah, you should get doubly involved and engaged, at least in social activism, if not outright political engagements. Yeah.
On that note, Ehsan, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much indeed.
That was O. Ehsan, Senior Fellow at the Singapore Institute of International Affairs, helping me make sense of this incredibly intense and messy week in Malaysian politics. If you missed any part of the conversation, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. I'm Dashan Johan, and this has been Beyond the Ballot Box, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.